Concludes the prosecution's submissions on the legal characterisation of the conflict, and I'll hand to Mr. Ferenz now.
Very clear, Mr. McCormack. Thank you very much. Mr. Ferenz.
May it please your honours, this is a historic moment in the evolution of international criminal law. For the first time, a permanent international criminal court will hear the closing statement for the prosecution as it concludes its first case against its first accused, Mr. Thomas Lubango Jila. I witnessed such an evolution. As an American soldier, I survived the indescribable horrors of World War II and served as a liberator of many concentration camps. Shortly thereafter, I was appointed a prosecutor at the Nuremberg War Crimes Trials, which mapped new rules for the protection of humanity. I was 27 years old then. I am now in my 92nd year, having spent a lifetime striving for a more humane world governed by the rule of law. I am honored to represent the prosecutor and to share some personal observations regarding the significance of this trial. The most significant advance I have observed in international law has gone almost unnoticed. It is the slow awakening of the human conscience. In 1948, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights proclaimed inalienable fundamental rights of all members of the human family as a foundation of freedom, peace, and justice in the world. Countless human rights declarations have been made over many years by many dedicated persons and organizations, but legal action to enforce those promises have been slow in coming. In Rome in 1998, when the statute that binds this court was overwhelmingly approved, over 100 sovereign states decided that child recruitment and forcing them to participate in hostilities were, and I'm quoting now from the statute, among the most serious crimes of concern for the international community as a whole.
Hello and welcome to Ethics Talk. That was Ben Ferenz, the famous prosecutor of the Nuremberg trials, giving the closing argument at the first case of the International Criminal Court, the prosecutor versus Thomas Dielo Lubanga. And this is Ethics Talk. And tonight we are talking about an historic conference convened by the International Criminal Court Student Network that happened just a few days ago in The Hague, Netherlands, on March 8th and 9th. You can look at the website for the conference at www.iccsn.com/Lubanga. We also encourage you to access our show resources page at ethicstalk.cmich, that's cmich.edu. Tonight we have a special show and a special guest. Megan Blue will be discussing with us and facilitating a discussion with myself, Hope May, and Erica Maley, who participated in this historic student conference. And so with that, I'm going to turn it over to Megan.
Hello, everyone. I guess that I would like to start off this wonderful conversation with handing a question over to Hope, who was one of the organizers of this historical conference. Hope, can you just give us a brief overview of the conference and why it was so important for you to put it on?
Sure. First, I want to just give a shout-out to my co-organizers, Victoria Fawn and Carolyn Vodilak. I apologize, Caroline, if I'm still mispronouncing your name. But Caroline, I will just say that Caroline and I met over the summer, and Caroline founded the International Criminal Court Student Network when she was a student at Cambridge in 2007. and I was drawn to the institution, the International Criminal Court Student Network, because of my passion for educating undergraduate students about the work of the International Criminal Court and about international criminal law. Carol and I sat down over tea in London and discussed the need for a conference, not only for the sake of bringing new people into the network, into the International Criminal Court Student Network, but also to memorialize the historical moment of the first case of the International Criminal Court. We really felt that it was an opportune moment to bring youth from all over the world to meet each other and to reflect upon the lessons learned in this very first case. And we met and we had this idea. And like so many things, it could have just gone by the wayside, but it didn't. We both took it seriously, and then Victoria came in, and we all sort of planned this over the Internet through Skype, and it was a truly amazing creation of an event. I've said this before, and I'll say it again, just to connect it with other historical movements in this country, in particular the women's suffrage movement. It was in London when Elizabeth Cady Stanton met with Lucretia Mott at the anti-slavery convention, and women were actually prevented from participating in the anti-slavery convention, and they had to go sit up in a balcony, and there were some men who were upset at that, and they sat with the women, and there Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Lucretia Mott, who were both from the United States but both called to London to this conference, had an idea to have a conference in the United States about women and getting women rights in the United States. They had this conversation in London, and then 8 years later, you had the Seneca Falls Conference, which marks the beginning of the women's movement in the United States. Carolyn and I, thank goodness, didn't take 8 years. Perhaps the imminency of the judgment was compelling us to really get this done. This was said at the conference that its realization and its actualization came about through this deep trust that Caroline and Victoria and I had for each other and for the vision of the International Criminal Court and the importance of education about it.
Interesting. Okay, now we're going to turn over to Erica here. Obviously, we know that the International Criminal Court Student Network played a large role in this conference. So, Erica, who is the president of the ICCSN here at Central Michigan, how did you first get involved with this?
Sure. Well, my participation in the International Criminal Court Student Network really began when I took HOPE's summer course this past summer in 2011, where we traveled to The Hague for a month, and we learned about the International Criminal Court and past courts and tribunals that had led into the creation of the ICC. We met with individuals that worked at the court, who worked at the CICC, and we really learned about how this institution operates. And not only that, though, we saw the inspiring work that it could do, myself and other students who participated in this class. So upon returning from this summer course, I knew that this was something that I wanted to be involved in. I'd always had an interest in international relations, human rights, justice, and so this was the perfect opportunity for me to take these interests and do something. So upon returning to CMU last semester, I joined the International Criminal Court Student Network with one other student, and we were able to accomplish a lot. You don't need a lot of people to get a lot done. And that's something that I really learned. If you're dedicated to the cause and you are passionate about what you do, you can do whatever you want. And that was something that I said on one of the final days at the International Criminal Court. Hope often asks, what's the most important thing that you learned? And standing outside the ICC, I said that I can do whatever I want. I can do whatever I set my mind out to do, I can do it. And I think that the International Criminal Court Student Network has just proved my involvement with this has proved that that's correct, that whatever I've wanted to do with this organization, I've done, and I hope to continue capitalizing on all the opportunities that it brings, but also creating my own opportunities, which I feel I've done and which I feel is really important for my development as a person, but also educating others about the ICC.
Hope, I'm going to turn that same question over to you. How did you get involved with it?
Sorry. how did I get involved with the ICCSN? Well, my first and original academic interest, if you will, was philosophy, and I first earned a PhD in philosophy, writing my dissertation on Aristotle. And I eventually decided to go to law school. And in law school, I took a class called International Law and Weapons of Mass Destruction. And in that class, I learned for the first time that there were such things called laws of war. I was completely blown away by these laws, and I also learned very briefly about the International Criminal Court. It was just mentioned as an aside. There was no class period devoted to it. There was probably about maybe a 15-minute discussion on it. And I was blown away by the idea of this court. And in fact, it was my honeymoon destination. As I always say, the International Court, that place of romance. Indeed, it was my honeymoon destination. And my husband and I visited the court. And when you visit the court, it's hit or miss. It could be that the proceedings are in closed session, so you're just sort of like sitting in the lobby. Or it could be there's some technical issue being discussed, but we were very fortunate to visit the court at a time when there was an actual child witness giving testimony. Sitting in the courtroom, I was completely blown away by the emotional power of the experience of watching this child testify. The child was speaking in a dialect, I believe, of Swahili. You know, you wear headphones because there's several languages going on. The child would say something, it would have to be translated and then translated again, and finally you would hear the translation on the headset. The rhythm of the court, the rhythm of the proceedings, the child, the emotional impact, the realness of it, the realizing that this is really what human rights looks like, this is what it looks like to take it seriously, blew me away, and I saw the educational value of it. I then immediately started to discuss with court personnel about the kind of education surrounding the court, and it was dismal. And I felt compelled to create a class focused solely on the International Criminal Court. I met with Karsten Stahn, who's the head of the Grotius Center at Leiden University, and I told him I would like to teach a class just focused on the court. He said, yes, it needs to be done. It doesn't exist. And came back, wrote up a study abroad class. You know, it all happened very quickly. And just in my preparation for the syllabus and all of that, I was led to the International Criminal Court Student Network. I saw that they had a web page, and I reached out to them. And Judy Fu, who was came along after Caroline and helped Caroline really build up the organization, responded to me, and we engaged in a correspondence. I met Judy in Leiden before I met Caroline, and I met, you know, the founders last summer. And so from then, I've had sort of deep involvement with the organization and pledged my dedication to it because I believe strongly that it is so important to involve students in the conversation about the ICC. It's a long project. It transcends our generation. It will be going on for several generations to realize the vision laid out in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. And I think if it wasn't for the internet, it just wouldn't have happened. And so I just want to, you know, give a shout out to technology and the role that it's played in the connections that are behind the International Criminal Court Student Network, and also the connections that happened at the conference in The Hague last week.
Definitely. I can see that this is something that's really near and dear to both of your hearts and that you definitely devote a lot of time to. So being at this conference, I just want to know, like, personal stories, exactly why it was so significant to you. Erica, we can start with you.
Sure. I think that I can look at this conference in two different ways. I can talk about what happened at the conference that made it significant, but I can also talk about, like, just how it came to be, like why it's important. And I think it's significant to me because it gave me something to strive towards. I knew that I really wanted to present at this conference, and that took a certain kind of development within me to push myself to prepare something that I could show at an international stage. This conference was significant for my development as far as feeling that I could speak about this topic and that I had the knowledge to share with others. And I know that I do have something to say that others could learn from. And I'm also it's also significant because I could learn from others. But I do want to talk about some things that happened at the conference that were really special, and that was, one, meeting new people with similar interest as me and who are like-minded. Sometimes it's really hard to carry on pursuing this passion of mine when there are so few people that really know about or are interested in my interests, which are human rights, international justice, and the International Criminal Court. Just because a lot of people don't know about it, and that's okay. That's our job now, is to let them know about it so they do understand it and care. But it's really hard when you don't have other people. So to meet other students and young professionals, and to be honest, age doesn't matter, because there were people there that were 10 years older than me. There were people there that were law students. There were people there that were undergraduates. It doesn't matter what type of individual or how old you are. We all shared something in common, and that was really special. And then another thing that was significant to me that occurred right before the conference started was the evening before the conference started, Hope and I were setting up, well, mainly Hope, I was helping, setting up the live stream equipment. And for me, that was a tremendous experience because I learned so much just about pushing onward. We worked on that for like over six hours. Mm-hmm. And I told Hope at the time, like, we were up at like 2 a.m. working on this, but there was like nowhere else I'd rather be, because like that was something that we wanted to do, and we accomplished it eventually, and we did it. And that's something that I just feel really proud about. I'm proud about representing my paper, but honestly, I'm proud of the time that Hope and I spent, and no one was watching and no one knew, but we were like just working on this together. And I learned so much, like not only about how to set up a computer, how to set up a camera, but I just learned a lot about just like keep going, like never stop. Just keep, if you want to do it, you can do it. You don't need any, you don't need help. You don't have to know how to do it before you actually go to try to do it. You can learn. I think that's something that's Hope has told me before, that you learn something by doing it. Mm-hmm. So if you're scared to do it, you have to do it in order to overcome your fear. And I think that I did both of those things that night. And so that was really special to me at the conference. And then the last thing that I'd like to talk about, that was, this is my third memory that's really special and significant to me, was actually a few days before the conference, but I was in The Hague with Hope. And this wouldn't have been possible without Hope and without her speaking with some individuals at the court, but I was actually able to visit the court in the PIDS office, which is the Public Information
Documentation
Section. Okay, thank you. And meeting with those individuals there, I think Parami helped me get in to the court and showed us around, and Violetta was in the office of PIDS. And so just meeting with them and hearing about the work that they do, which is about outreach and making sure people understand what it is the court does, how they work in the field, how they work with victims. And so their work is really important in sharing with the global community what's going on. And so it was just wonderful to have that opportunity to go in and speak with those people, which I never would have had if it hadn't been for the Knowing Hope, taking the summer course, joining the ICCSN, and coming to this conference. So,
well, it could have happened through another path.
Right. Yeah, okay.
It could have happened.
It could have happened, but I don't think it would have happened so quickly, and I don't think it would have been as meaningful to me. So that's something else that's very significant and something that I really enjoyed, and I'm just so thankful for all of these opportunities.
Definitely. All right, Hope. What about your significance?
Right. So just to first build off of something that Erica said about PIDS, the Public Information and Documentation section, I said this at the conference that, you know, one of my, I would say, the primary objective that I have in educating others about the International Criminal Court is to show to everyone how the court is so beyond a courtroom, that it is a collection of many different skill sets, including legal skill sets, but interpreters are absolutely crucial, not only in the courtroom, but with communication. And so it's an international court. And so when it's telling its story, there needs to be people there who can communicate not just in English, not just in French, but in Arabic and Swahili, so forth. And in fact, if you go onto the YouTube channel of the court, most of the videos are in French. And that's because the PIDS section is really strapped for resources. The court is going through a budgetary crisis right now. And I just want to acknowledge the extremely important work that PIDS does. They tell the story of the court in a language that the average person can understand. And the average person's understanding is absolutely essential to this project that Ben Ferenz was talking about in his closing remarks in Lubanga, this awakening of the human conscience. This is not something that's reserved for an elite few people. It involves all of humanity, and therefore you need many skill sets and many storytellers. And PIDS does that, and I just want to acknowledge the crucially important work that they do and the graciousness of that office in speaking with us and in helping us. This conference is significant to me because it is the first, it's marking the first trial of the International Criminal Court. And as Ben Ferenz says in his closing remarks of Lubanga, this is an evolution of international criminal law. And as an American citizen, I felt it really important that America be there. And in fact, the U.S. ambassador for, the title has changed, but it used to be war crimes issues, and now it's global criminal justice. The U.S. ambassador for global criminal justice, Stephen J. Rapp, did grace us with his presence. And I thought that was extremely significant and extremely poignant that the United States played a role. It wasn't just the United States. It was also our good friends in England and Cambridge who helped organize the conference. But the United States was there in an important capacity because Central Michigan University generously supported the conference. Stephen J. Rapp was an American diplomat. His role is sort of the person who interacts with the ICC. The United States State Department sends him out to the Assembly of States parties, and he wanted to come to the conference. He wanted to be involved in a student conference. And so it was just important for me to sort of give a message to the world, because the world has been sort of upset at the United States because we're not a member of the International Criminal Court, and the Bush administration had a very hostile approach to the court. In fact, it was the objective to actually make sure that the court doesn't function, and so that, of course, upset the international community. So it was really important for me as an American not only to show the world and other students that there are Americans who do care about the court, but also that we care about educating. And the preamble of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights states that, you know, the goal of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, to put it in a nutshell, is rule of law, a global rule of law that's really there to cultivate and protect human dignity. And that to realize that goal, like right after the sentence where it says, you know, let this be a common standard, blah, blah, blah. And then right after that it says, every individual and every organ of society shall strive by teaching and education to promote respect for these fundamental rights and freedoms. And that means, you know, every individual and every organ of society, that's everything. That means everybody has a role to play. That means that if human dignity is going to be a reality and not just a rhetorical term, not just a political term that people throw out, but if it's actually to be meaningful, then everybody has a job to play. And so taking that solemn duty quite seriously, that's why the conference was important to me. As an American and as a person who totally believes that the rule of law should cultivate and protect human dignity, I felt that this conference was a means to help that goal. I by no means think that we're that close to it. I think that this is something that will go on for generations, and I think it's extremely important that we continue to educate and inspire young people, because eventually there will be a generation that does it. You heard Ben Ferenz. He's now in his 90s. He's been working on this for his whole life. And it's a project that will take several generations. Again, to mention the women's movement, Susan B. Anthony did not see women get the right to vote in her own lifetime. She had the presence of mind to train a generation of women younger than her to carry on that work. And I hope that we all realize how huge this task is and that we're mindful of young people and people who are just being born now, to communicate with them the importance of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and this very important history that unfortunately is not told to everybody.
Interesting. I guess I just want to shoot back a question back to you. I can see that this is such a big deal because I've been kind of educated towards it and learning about it through classes and that kind of stuff. But people who don't really know anything about the ICC or the fact that the United States isn't a part of it, do you think that this conference is taking a big enough leap to educate others about it, or...
I would say yes, because the people that were at the conference are leaders in their own way and in their own countries and among youth and among any age about the ICC. And so for them to be to have the opportunity to speak with American students about this, I think that they learned something. And in fact, I heard that from some of them, that I know that the United States isn't a party to the Rome Statute. But it's so nice to see that you do care, that as American citizens, you do want to be involved with the International Criminal Court. So I think that this was a tremendous step as far as the United States showing the world that we do want to participate and we do care. I think I definitely think it had an impact. And I think that other people will take that information and hopefully a ripple effect will occur in where they share this information with others and others continue to share that information.
Yeah, and I also want to say that the CONI 2012 Invisible Children campaign is something that's deeply connected with this court. And because of, and we have a chapter of the Invisible Children here at Central Michigan University. Caitlin Shevers is the president, and she and Randy Schaefer gave a paper at the conference. And I've been talking to Caitlin for over a year now because we both realize that the ICCSN and Invisible Children have shared interests, because Joseph Kony is the very first indictee of the International Criminal Court. They haven't caught him yet. And the Lubanga case is so important for Invisible Children because Lubanga is a guy that they, quote, caught and tried, and he's been charged with enlisting and conscripting child soldiers. And so it's the same issue. And so I think the purpose of the CONI campaign is to draw attention to this terrible state of affairs that exists, where children are abducted by rebels and forced to kill their families. And this is one of the children that I saw when I went to the ICC, and this wasn't even the Lubanga case. I was sitting in on the Katanga case, okay? So this is a huge problem, and the ICC is one of the mechanisms that's addressing it. But the Kony 2012 video was shown at the conference, and it had just been released days before. And Caitlin and I had been talking about this prior to the conference, and it was just really, really timely, fortuitous that it happened. And I think the incredible momentum and attention that that video has gained is a great opportunity to teach people about the International Criminal Court, because the International Criminal Court is shown in the Kony 2012 video. He is the current prosecutor now, Luis Moreno Ocampo, but he will be done with his term, I believe, in June. And we have a new prosecutor, Fatou Bensouda, who's a female from Gambia, and she was just elected, and actually Erica and I witnessed her election in New York at the Assembly of States parties, a really moving moment. And so there are characters from the International Court in the Kony 12 video. It shows the court. It says The Hague, Netherlands. Unfortunately, Luis Moreno Ocampo uses the word indictment, which the International Criminal Court doesn't really indict people, and this is why it's hard to teach. But the takeaway point that I'm trying to come to is that the Kony 2012 campaign presents us with an opportunity to really educate American youth about the International Criminal Court, about the fact that we're not a member, and perhaps try to create a movement at least about education, hopefully towards ratification and signing this treaty. That's not the end. Once you sign the treaty, there's all this other legislation that has to be put into place called implementation legislation. But, you know, it's a movement forward. The Obama administration and the State Department that's dealing with the International Criminal Court, because the Bush administration was so hostile to it, the new individuals dealing with the ICC have used this phrase, reset the default, that we're sort of resetting our relationship with the court. And this conference and the U.S. presence there and Ambassador Rapp there shows that there's this now movement towards a more friendly relationship with the court. And again, the Kony 2012 gives us an opportunity to continue that movement forward.
Okay. Going off of the Invisible Children coming in and presenting, were there, obviously there's other different presentations, what other papers and stuff were presented at the conference that kind of played into this?
Sure. Well, I can at least speak about what I presented. My paper was on restorative and retributive justice as it relates to the International Criminal Court and what we can learn from Invisible Children. Right now, at first glance, it seems that the International Criminal Court is focused on retributive justice, which is bringing the accused to a trial and having them claim accountability. And it really is pursuing justice through legal means, whereas restorative justice takes a more holistic approach and deals with healing and rehabilitation and working with these communities and victims of these crimes in order to heal. It greatly involves communication in order for them to understand the root of the problem and ultimately act as a deterrent, hopefully, ideally. But I talk about how, in my paper, like I said, at first glance it appears the ICC is focused on retributive justice, but in fact their work with victims and their participation in the court, victims are actually allowed to give testimony and share evidence in the proceedings, and also their work with the Trust Fund for Victims, which and through reparations, which would be after a case is completed, then reparations could be ordered to victims in order to help them rebuild their lives. So I talk about how the Rome Statute, where these things are talked about, does imply that the ICC recognizes restorative justice, but due to the fact that it's really focused on retributive justice right now, it's having a hard time of realizing this restorative justice. So in my paper, I analyze the ICC and also Invisible Children and talk about how Invisible Children can show by example some ways that the ICC could incorporate more aspects of restorative justice into its current outreach strategy. What Invisible Children currently has is called a protection plan, and so I compared the protection plan to the outreach strategy. And I think it's important for me to say here, just because I want it to be clear, and also I had to be careful to make this clear at the conference, that I realize that Invisible Children and the International Criminal Court have two separate purposes and two separate missions. But I think that we can learn from each other, and we can learn of the strategies mm-hmm. that Invisible Children has used. Clearly, they're having incredible success right now in gaining awareness for what they're doing mm-hmm. and gaining support. And so even in those ways, if the International Criminal Court could achieve this type of following, I think that would greatly help in realizing all of its goals, but also incorporating restorative justice into what it is. So my full paper is much longer, but that's a highlight of what it is. And as far as other people presenting, there were so many topics discussed. I mean, we had maybe five or six different sections or panels mm-hmm. of individuals throughout the two-day conference. And it was just really enlightening to hear what everybody had to say and how, I mean, there's so much to learn and so much to be analyzed. The court is really young, and I think that there can be there's a lot of room for people to, critique or see where improvements could be made or see where things are working well. And so I was just amazed at how many different things that people talked about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, in addition to the papers that were given, we had several keynote speakers. One was Nicole Sampson, and actually, if you're interested, you can see the agenda and the agenda of the conference at the conference website, iccsn.com/Lubanga. It's a two-day conference, and in addition to the papers, and I think there are around 20 papers that were given, there were a number of keynotes, and I just want to talk about the keynotes. So we had a keynote from the lovely and talented Matthew Kanick from the Coalition of the International Criminal Court. We had a keynote from Nicole Sampson, who's a senior trial lawyer who worked closely on the Lubanga case. We had a keynote from Vedrana Ladina, who works with victims, and she is there when the victims and witnesses are being questioned by the prosecutor to just make sure that they're not being traumatized by the whole process. Of course, I've mentioned Stephen J. Rapp, the U.S. Ambassador for War Crimes, Elizabeth Evanson, the Senior Counsel for Human Rights Watch. And so there were some really wonderful speakers that brought their expertise, and it was a wonderful learning opportunity for students to learn from each other and also for them to interact with leaders in the field and people who worked really closely on Lubanga. So it was a really nice mix of information. And it's funny, just focusing on one case. I mean, I think we maybe scratched the surface with the Lubanga case. It's just so rich. It's a dense layer of stories that need to be unraveled. And every case is like that, which is why it's very unfortunate that the current education involves dropping students into a courtroom for maybe 30 minutes without fully appreciating the complexity of the court that transcends what goes on in the courtroom and involves, like I said before, outreach, interpretation, psychologists, political scientists, working with state governments and so forth. So, right, it was a full 2 days. And I should also say that we did live stream the whole conference, and most of the archives are online, but they will be prominently displayed at the Lubanga website, which I've mentioned, iccsn.com/Lubanga. There will be sort of like a widget that you can click on and watch the proceedings. We also had like an interactive chat with part of the software, and we had people sending questions in from Khartoum, from London, from the Netherlands, and they were able to participate as well.
I think something that's really interesting about the conference itself is that it was truly international. Mm-hmm. It wasn't just Americans in The Hague. It was a whole bunch of people together. So this is something that kind of plays a factor worldwide. And we talked about why the conference was significant to you, but why do you think that it's so big on the world stage? Why is it significant for others to know about it?
Sure. I think right now, and we've kind of touched on this a little bit right now, this is so important and so significant to the world because everybody's talking about Kony, but Lubanga is happening now, okay? The Kony case will happen if has the opportunity to come before the court. But Lubanga is occurring right now, and people don't know about it. And so I think it's really important that we discussed it in the way that we did, and that it was so international, like you just said, because we can take that back and we can share that with others. And so it's significant in showing that, one, people do care, but also people don't know what's going on. And it's important that we become more aware. I think that's a good summary of what I wanted to say. What do you have to say, Hope?
Yeah, I mean, to, again, go back to the Ben Ferenz statement, the closing statement, it's a new world. International law, really, you know, starting with Nuremberg, has completely changed because there was a time when state sovereignty was really the rule of the day. That is, and it's really, in the United States, we call this relativism, and it's seen as, well, who am I to say that something is wrong, right? And so in our culture, cultural relativism is really, really rampant amongst young people. Well, who's to say that X is right or wrong? Who am I to say that X is wrong? Imagine that at the global level, where you have states going, well, who am I to say that what Nazi Germany is, you know, that what they're doing is wrong? And basically what happened with Nuremberg in the mid-40s is led by the United States and President Roosevelt, that we decided to say, you know what, there are certain things that are wrong that you just cannot do, to quote my good friend Ebba Leckvall from Oxford. She's the president of the Oxford chapter of the ICCSN, and she's quoting her very important professor, Susan Perry, torture is not a state function. Like, this is just not something that a state can do. Genocide, not a state function, right? Child soldiering, not a state function. And so for the international community to get together and sort of lay out norms, like universal norms, that, you know, it doesn't matter if you're a head of state, that is truly a new world. And for the average citizen to know that there are certain things that their government cannot do to them is extremely important. Because if you don't know, then you just accept it. And so this is important on the world stage because, the project of human dignity is to be taken seriously, so it's not just a word used for rhetorical or PR purposes, but it's actually a substantive value that's respected, then everybody knows what a state, what their government can and cannot do. And then, of course, as Ben Ferenc says, it's not enough to have documents and resolutions. It's not enough to say, to lay out, okay, a state can't do this. Then you need institutions to actually enforce the norms. And that is what the International Criminal Court does. And so someone has called the International Criminal Court, someone from Lawyers for Justice in Libya, a symbol of hope, meaning that when a state is committing such egregious wrongs to its people, that the International Criminal Court is something that they can look to and, you know, hope that some justice will be done. Whether or not it works depends on us, because it could not work. This was the hope of the United Nations, and the United Nations didn't exactly comply with what, didn't make good on its words in the 90s with Rwanda and the Balkans. So we'll see if we take it seriously now, but I absolutely think it depends on all of us and on educating generations of people who come after us. So that's why it's important.
Okay.
In my view.
All right. Well, I just think that it's something that is a lot bigger than we can really kind of wrap our head around right now, and it will be seen in the future as things with the ICC and it kind of becomes more of a worldwide thing and people actually know about it, starting with, you know.
And actually, if I could, I think it'd be interesting to hear what you thought about it as like as someone hearing about what was happening at the conference, or a new student that's wanting to become part of the work that the ICCSN does. So I think that you should have an opportunity to answer this question.
Thank you. I guess it's kind of interesting to me because before I decided to take Hope's class in probably November of last year, I decided to be crazy and sign up for it. I didn't really know anything about the International Criminal Court. I couldn't tell you what the International Criminal Court Student Network was or what it did. And now hearing about this conference and kind of what it's working towards means a lot to me because it's something that's so new that it doesn't be if I hadn't known about it, I guess I wouldn't really – it wouldn't change my – life per se. I would just kind of go along with it as any other American college student probably would. But now that I understand what's going on and the fact that there are such big issues facing the ICC, I've heard of Invisible Children before and what they've tried to, like what they're working towards, and I thought that was a cool idea, but I never saw it really in action in a court system, someone trying to be tried for those crimes. And now that it's being, the ruling is being handed down, it's kind of looking towards of what can actually happen, I guess. I just, to me, it's just something that's really important, and I wish that I had known about it sooner, and knowing that I can be involved at this point in my life and spread this knowledge and information to other people through letting them know about this conference and even just the ICCSN is something that's really empowering to me. And going back to your answer earlier about how being a part of this conference and everything that you've done has kind of shown you that you can make a difference. You can be a part of something this big and in such a short amount of time, which is what I'm trying to do. So, yeah.
Cool.
Yeah, that's good to hear.
All right.
Now it's improvisation time. We have 11 minutes left. And, anybody have anything to say that's coming to them? It's also important to take a moment of quiet, of silence. These moments are so few and far between, but let me say something about something that... something about Invisible Children that I communicated with Caitlin recently in an email, if I recall. So, right. Right now, Kony 2012, viral. Everybody's going nuts about it. But Invisible Children has been around for a long time. And Caitlin has been working with Invisible Children for 5 years. Okay? So... Wendy Kopp, who is one of my heroes, who founded Teach for America when she was a student at Princeton, has said in her public lectures that I've had the privilege of watching over the internet, thank God for the internet, has said that she's really worried about young people and their failure to stick with something. And I want to just give a shout-out to Invisible Children for sticking with this campaign. They have been doing, Kony for many years, going back to the very first movie, I believe it's called The Rescue. So this is not something that they just were doing overnight. They've been working on it. They've been focused and working on it. And Wendy Kopp has said, like, that without her focus, Teach for America could have not come to be. And you will face challenges, and you will face failures. And the thing is that you must keep going. It goes back to what Erica was saying the night that we were setting up. I mean, the amount of failures that we were encountering, it was actually so many that it was comic. We just started laughing because it was absurd. And we were talking about, you know, if we can't get through this night, and we're thinking about the soldiers in Afghanistan who are fighting, you know, without any sleep and food. And, you know, there are so many stories of people who have suffered through much worse than setting up at a conference the night before and having the sound system crap out on us. And so this importance of staying the course, and again, Invisible Children, Wendy Kopp, Susan B. Anthony, that, you know, you've got to stay the course. And eventually the value that's trying to come into the world and be born will be realized, because it's right and everybody feels that it's right. And so I just want to give a shout out for tenacity and sticking with things and grit, because I think it's something in our culture that is not stressed enough. A lot of people go from one thing to another, or they're challenged and they leave it. But commitment and focus is absolutely essential to seeing the task through.
I agree, and I think that this also is just, it's a time for me to say that, like, how moved I was hearing the clip at the start of the show when he said that he gave that speech when he was 27 and now he's 92. I mean, I just it's hard to fathom the idea of dedicating that much of your time and your whole life. And I'm like so thankful for the people that do that, because without them, where would we be?
I totally agree. And when I had the great privilege of meeting Mr. Ferenz, who's just the kindest, warmest, unpretentious, loving, joyful being, like when we parted, he said, keep up the work. And Susan B. Anthony, and when she died, she said, because she didn't see her dream realized, in her will, she said something like, do not weep, continue the work. Like, it's the work that's important. And I just, I think about people like that, and I think that the least we can do is honor them with our work, because they were thinking, Susan B. Anthony was thinking about us, Ben Ferenz is thinking about us and the people who come after us, and we should be thinking about the people who come after us. And I don't know about you guys, but when I think about doing things for the people who come after me, when I'm food for worms. Maybe I'll be cremated and I won't be anybody's food. But when I think about the people who come after me, it gives me a very special kind of energy and motivation. And so I think it's really important that we remember that it's not about us. And to quote the title of a fabulous documentary on Susan B. Anthony, which we have been talking about for the past 2 weeks on the show, by the way, like, that was the sort of shows that were leading up to this show, Not for Ourselves Alone is the title, and I highly recommend anybody to watch it. So another moment of reflection. Okay, fine, I'll kick in again if you don't mind.
Please do.
So this thing about all the hits that Kony 2012 is getting, quantity being emphasized. Oh, wow, it's 1 billion hits in 3 days. Oh, my God, it's 10 billion hits in 2 weeks. You know what? Superficial. Okay, so is every person clicking on a video paying attention? Are they watching the whole thing? Question number one, you have no idea. They could be playing it, and they're playing with their dog, and they're not paying attention. So it doesn't really say anything about whether or not people are really getting the message. In fact, given the criticism about the movie, that strongly suggests that people really aren't paying attention to the movie. So I want to say that our culture, which is obsessed with getting a lot of hits and getting maximal likes and maximal friends, you know what? I really don't think that means much. If you look at the people who've accomplished things, it's a handful of people. The International Committee of the Red Cross, 5 people. I was earlier today talking about the film Chariots of Fire, which is a true story about the Olympics after World War I, and 2 amazing athletes competing in it. And one of them, Mr. Abrahams, trains with a coach, Sam Musubini. It's 2 people. And Mr. Abrahams wins the race, and there's this conversation after he wins the race, and they both realize, like, this is about you and me. Like, we did this, and this is a huge thing. It's a huge thing for Cambridge, because Mr. Abrahams is a student of Cambridge. But, like, in terms of the real work that made it happen, it's 2 people. And so Invisible Children started out as a handful of people. So our focus on numbers and hits is alarming to me, and I think that the more important thing is the actual people who do the work, and those are really, really hard to find, the people who do the work and who are doing it for the right reasons. And so I would say let's not get all excited if there's 30 billion hits and in a week. It's great, but then what? Then what?
I would agree with you, but also kind of disagree
with
you.
I love it. Thank you. I love the but.
Because I think that with Kony 2012 kind of exploding, it serves its purpose of letting people know what's going on. Granted, yes, some people are not going to listen to what it says of paying closely attention, because they obviously didn't. But I think that it has extended to the mark much farther than all the other Invisible Children actions and other videos that they've tried to do. And people who've never really heard about Invisible Children or had and haven't really done anything have been mobilized to sort of take action, where I have seen on my Facebook it's like blowing up, and people are all, there's events for every major city about Cover the Night and that kind of stuff. And I've never really seen that many people really be pushed to wanting to take action on that. So while, yes, there's going to be those who watch it, complain about it, and say that we shouldn't be doing this or not understand the point, there's going to be numerous others who are actually going to take part in it and actually try to make a difference instead of just silently clicking the share button on their YouTube and be done.
Sure. And indeed, this goes to, like, what's the ultimate objective here? If the ultimate objective is awareness, which we probably have it now, then what? Like, awareness for the sake of what? In fact, the issue of child soldiers, it goes beyond the International Criminal Court. And let me give a shout-out to Radhika Kumaraswamy's office. Right. Just Google Special Representative of the Secretary General for Children in Armed Conflict, because she's going at the problem from a totally different angle. We didn't even talk about that office. So it's like the ICC, there's Invisible Children. And if it's like the substantive issue of child soldiers, that's the aim of this campaign, then there's a tremendous amount of education that the person has to take on themselves. And I will be interested to see if the Cover the Night campaign leads to discussions about Radhika Kumaraswamy's work. That's all I'm saying. And I would love it, but we'll see. With that, you've been listening to Ethics Talk. Have a great evening. Tomorrow is the verdict of Lubanga, a historical moment in time. You can watch it. Don't crash the ICC website. It's not a strong infrastructure there. They are live streaming it, icc-cpi.int, link on our show resources page. Good night.